Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it and put it on your iPod, iPad, computer, or just click on the internet. Before we start, I'd like to recognize first a birthday of sorts. On May 2nd, while I was in Barcelona and the whole predictive coding world was going crazy, ESI Bytes turned 3 years old. So this is our 170th podcast. We have no cakes or singing, please, but I can't think of a better show to kick off celebrating our 30-year anniversary than the one we're going about to do, which is talking about some of the issues that are out there now today in predictive coding and some of the cases that are being litigated, primarily the Silva Moore case. So this is a real interesting show. It's come about rather quickly due to the events occurring in the predictive coding world. With two cases in the press, it's hard to read legal publications without stumbling into something related to predictive coding, and there are lots of questions and confusion by lawyers on how to validate the process, you know, which judges to bring cases in front of, what does this mean to discovery today. And we're going to jump into these types of issues today, and I'm pleased to have one of the industry experts on predictive coding on the show, Herb Reutblatt. Herb is one of the pioneers in search and retrieval and the chief scientist at Orchitech, which is a predictive coding and analytics software tool. Prior to this, he was the chief scientist and co-founder of Dolphin Search, as well as an award-winning professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii. He's been awarded one patent and has two patents pending on conceptual searching technology. Herb's well-recognized as an expert in search and retrieval technology, particularly in the area of e-discovery. In addition to his scientific work, Herb has been writing extensively about the problems of dealing with massive amounts of electronic data and the emerging standards of dealing with those problems. He's a member of the Sedona Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, on the advisory board of the Georgetown Legal Center Advanced E-Discovery Institute, a member of the 2011 Program Committee for Georgetown Legal Center Advanced E-Discovery Institute, and the chair of the Electronic Discovery Institute. He's a member of the Board of Governors of the Organization of Legal Professionals, and he's a frequent speaker on e-discovery, particularly concerning search, categorization, predictive coding, and quality assurance. Herb, thanks for joining us on the show here, and I'd like to start the show and talk a little bit about, given the allegations in the De Silva Moore case, I'd like to ask a new form question for all predictive coding shows going forward. Have you, in fact, been paid to do this free ESI Bytes program, or are you, in fact, paying me to be doing this program?
Neither of those. I'm not paying you, you're not paying me. But I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for this opportunity. I do want to point out, as you just said, that
there's a reason for that question. There's an allegation in the De Silva Moore case that there's plaintiff's brief that there's some sort of collusion among experts to push this field forward for economic gain. I mean, it's bizarre is the way I describe it. I blogged about it at DocReviewMD. I don't really want to talk about it much, but I just thought I'd throw it out there to you, Herb. You want to tell people where you're coming from in this and be completely candid?
Yes, I do. As you said, we have a software tool. We have a company called Orchitech that does predictive coding and analytics. I do have a financial interest in that company. I've also written a peer-reviewed paper on this topic that came out in January of 2010. That did not involve our technology, but involved two other technologies. And at the time, there was no conflict, although there's been some hints that some people thought there might have been in a recent blog attacking, like everybody else, attacking the eDiscovery Institute as well. But we didn't have any conflicts at the time. I didn't start doing our Orchitech predictive coding until after that in February of 2010.
Okay, so let's go deeper into the more substantive issues in De Silva Moore. First of all, what is this dispute about?
Well, so far as I can tell, the main objection that's of substance that's in their brief is whether they should sample 2,399 documents or sample 16,555 non-responsive documents at the end of the predictive coding. I don't think that that is worthy of all of the brouhaha that's been raised. I don't think that it's worthy of the ad hominem attacks that have been going on. There are some other legal arguments in there that I will leave to the lawyers to deal with. But today what I'd like to talk about are some of the facts regarding sampling and regarding what the claims and objections are based around sampling and information retrieval.
Okay. Are the plaintiffs in this case actually objecting to the use of predictive coding?
No, they're not. They agreed several times that predictive coding was not the issue, and many times they said, but the devil is in the details, and I think they get a lot of those details wrong. They agreed in the beginning to do predictive coding. They continued to say in this latest brief that we agreed to predictive coding provided that it was accurate, and then ignore those statements and raise a lot of objections to predictive coding that I think are ill-founded.
So, you know, at a high level, the key to cooperating with an adversary in e-discovery is having confidence and trust that you're getting what you expect to receive. And lots of people, the Sedona Conference judges signed the cooperation proclamation, agree that the fight at discovery wastes a lot of resources. So you got to have trust. How can statistics help the parties get comfortable? Because these parties clearly aren't comfortable right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, statistics can help you to identify whether you're doing a reasonable job. Now, what exactly reasonable means is the kind of decision that lawyers and judges are comfortable making. What statistics can do is to help you to translate those decisions about what constitutes reasonableness to cast them in a mathematical form that you can then test. And I think that if we strip away all of the noise in this dispute, it ultimately comes down to, are we doing a reasonable job of discovery, and how do we evaluate that we're doing a reasonable job? So I think that we should spend some time, you and I, talking about how statistics can help us to understand the reasonableness or unreasonableness of the results that we get out of predictive coding or any other means of identifying which documents are responsive.
Yeah, and we'll definitely tie this back into the status quo of what we currently do today at the end. But it seems to me that much of this dispute can be resolved about doing some random sampling. Both sides are talking about it. And for the lawyers in the audience, how does random sampling work? But incidentally, before I ask the question, I want to mention we did cover some of this in a podcast I did with Herb Reutblad and Dave Lewis last year. And Dave, incidentally, is testifying as one of the experts in the Clean case, the other predictive coding case going on right now in the Seventh Circuit, and I highly recommend that show to everyone as a supplement to this one. How does the random sampling work?
Well, in random sampling, every object that you want to sample from, in our case it's documents, every object has an equal chance of participating in the sample. And there are multiple ways of making sure that every document has an equal chance. Sometimes we have stratified random sampling. Sometimes we have simple random sampling. Stratified random sampling means that we sample each group in proportion to its contribution to the whole population. Simple random sampling means we basically pull document IDs out of a figurative hat. And as long as everyone has an equal chance, then you can make statistical inferences about the results. The reason you want a random sample is because a random sample is the most representative of the population. If you find some facts that are true of a random sample, so for example, you might find that 1.25% or 1.5% of the documents in a particular random sample are responsive, then depending on the size of the sample, you can assume that somewhere around 1.25% or 1.5% of the whole population is also going to be responsive. The limits that you employ depend on the size of the sample and on your confidence level, and we'll get to those in a little bit.
Okay. And in this case, there's been a lot of debate about the sample size that each side is proposing. The plaintiffs are now talking about 16,555 non-responsive documents being sampled, and the defendants proposed 2,399. How does the sample size affect confidence?
Generally speaking, the larger the sample size, the higher the confidence. And we have confidence level, and we have confidence interval. The confidence level is how confident are you in this particular result. So in essence, we'd say if we did the same experiment 100 times, how many times would the results come out within a certain range? And the answer is the higher your confidence level, the more confident you are that repeating the experiment would repeat the same general kinds of results. The confidence interval is the range that those scores would appear in. And I'm simplifying a little bit, but basically when you have, for example, an election poll, you know, the question is Romney or Santorum ahead? And we might say that Romney is ahead by, 52 to 48%, plus and minus 5%. So the plus and minus 5% is the confidence interval. And we assume, usually, if nothing else is being said, that the confidence level is 95%. That means in 95% of your surveys of the same people, or of any people, you'd find out that the range of scores comes out close to the value that that's predicted, plus or minus X percent. And that's the X percent, the plus and minus, is the confidence interval, and the overall confidence level is 95%.
Okay, and one of the, let's talk about the impact of the larger sample size. With predictive coding, as with any process used to try to identify responsive documents, you're going to miss documents. It's completely unavoidable. And Judge Peck even said that in his opinion that we're not looking for perfection here. Does using a larger sample size just give the plaintiffs a bigger opportunity to torture the defendants with examples of what they've left behind, or what do you see behind the reason for that larger sample size?
Well, I think the main reason that they want that larger sample size is because they're misreading some of the TREC results. But I think we can get to that later. I think that the larger the sample size, larger sample sizes are better at estimating things like what is the frequency of responsive documents. A larger sample size can also help you to find more documents that make you worried, if that's the way you want to think about it, that the bigger the sample, the more likely there are to be documents that will make you worried. But it doesn't necessarily help you to do a better job, because there's a big trade-off. As you go from a small sample to a bigger sample, you get good value. You get a high increase in the confidence level, or you get a high decrease in the confidence interval. But as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you get less and less value out of it. So not only is there an expense associated with reviewing more documents, but the value of paying that expense diminishes as the size of the sample increases.
So there's no real statistical reason to be expanding the sample other than a distrust in the comfort you're getting from the statistics. It's turning it closer and closer into reviewing all the documents, or more of the documents. The more you review,
right,
the more you see.
Well, that's right. And look, if you want to make sure that you find all the responsive documents, the only sure way to do that is to return all the documents in the collection. Then you're guaranteed to have found all the responsive documents in the collection. But that's rarely acceptable.
Okay. Does the sample size depend on the number of documents in the collection?
Not really. I mean, there are some small variations. There are lots of formulas for computing the optimal sample size and so on. And historically, we've relied on approximations to calculate those sample sizes. So, for example, if you want to calculate the proportion of documents that are responsive in a collection, or you want to calculate the recall rate in a particular collection, then you need to use factorials. So you multiply 50 times 49 times 48 times 47. It's only been recently that we've been able to have computers that will actually do that calculation, and they can still take a long time. So instead, what people have used are approximations. And if you use certain approximations to the estimate, you may end up including 4, 5, 6, 10 more documents in your collection. If you use the exact formula and take the time to do all the factorial computations out of it, you may include a few fewer. But generally speaking, those approximations that are based on other distributions are statistically validated for many, many years. This stuff has been going on for 100 years, and are very close approximations. If you round up a little bit, you'll never have to worry about the size of the population.
Okay. Can a sample be statistically significant?
No, that's a word that keeps getting misused, I think, in this space. Statistical significance refers, I'm sorry, to the difference between two scores. And the question is, if you take two random samples, they're going to not necessarily be identical because of the nature of sampling. And because, remember, we talked about the confidence interval and the confidence level. Well, the confidence interval is going to include the value, but they don't always have to be exactly identical. What we want to know is, what's the probability that a result that we observe between two samples, what's the probability that that difference appeared by chance? That is, were they drawn from the same population? And if the probability is very low, by convention in most scientific studies, 95% is the confidence level. So if the probability is less than 5% that they were drawn from the same sample, then we can say that the difference is statistically significant. Samples themselves are not significant or not significant, not at least if you mean statistically significant. Samples are either valid or they're invalid, depending on how they're collected. Samples are either sufficiently large to be able to meet your criteria for your sampling, for your confidence interval and confidence level, but they themselves can't be significant, and it's just a misuse of the term to say that they are.
Okay, now let's turn to information retrieval measures. You know, what are some of the common information retrieval measures, and how are they used? I know we covered this with Dave Lewis on the previous podcast, but it's worth including it here, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the most common ones are precision and recall. Precision refers to the specificity of the search. How specifically did the system return only responsive documents? Remember a few minutes ago I talked about if you want to make sure that you retrieve all of the responsive documents, simply retrieve all the documents. But that entails, a lot of work, and people aren't always... It's not always appropriate to do that if for no other reason than the fact that reading them all is very, very expensive. But then if you want to control how well you're doing, you don't want to swamp the other side with too many irrelevant documents, then we want to have high precision so that we return just the responsive documents. Recall refers to the completeness of our retrieval, of our predictive coding or something. To have high recall means to retrieve all of the responsive documents. And what you would like is to have high recall, and perhaps you want to minimize the precision as much as you can, but the more important thing typically in e-discovery is to have high recall.
Yeah, you don't want to leave documents behind,
right,
if possible.
Right.
So then how do you compute recall? Because you know, that's that's at the heart of you know of all this. You know, what do you think there before you start, right?
Right. Well, particularly it's at the heart, I think, of this complaint, of the objection in this brief. That is, they claim that they need an adequate sample to be able to compute recall. Recall is very simple. It's a decimal fraction where the numerator is the number of responsive documents that have been identified by the retrieval system, predictive coding, if you will, and the numerator is the number of responsive documents in the whole collection. Now, you can apply the same sort of thing to a sample, and you can say, in this sample, what proportion of documents have been predicted to be responsive and versus what proportion of documents actually are responsive. And you compare those two values, and that's recall. So it's proportion of responsive documents in the collection that have been appropriately identified by your retrieval system. One of the interesting things in this particular matter is their big argument is about whether there should be 2,399 or 16,555 documents randomly chosen from the reject pile, if you will, from the documents that the system has identified as non-responsive. If the system has identified these documents as non-responsive, you don't have your numerator. The numerator depends on documents that the system has predicted to be responsive. If there aren't any, you can't compute recall from this value. So
all you can do is say
problem.
What everyone knows. There's some that are included because there's no perfection. But
there's no perfection. There are some that are included. There are some other measures that could be used to evaluate this, but they were not they were not discussed in this particular in this particular case. But the point is, they're arguing about a number that really has no practical implications for what they say they want to be able to find as a result of that number.
Hmm. Well, are there other measures that lawyers can use to try to get comfortable or create more work for statisticians?
Yes, there are other numbers. And, you know, all of these numbers are really pretty easy to do. I will tell you that an early paper that I wrote about elusion, which is something I'll describe in a second, Judge Shindlin looked at that paper, looked at the equation that was in there, and said, "Judges are expected to know this stuff?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I'm sorry, but it's true." But it's actually quite simple. So rather than computing recall from the non-responsive set, however big the sample is, one of the things that you can do is compute elusion, where elusion is the relative number of documents that have been missed, that have been left behind. It's not the same thing as a miss in information retrieval terms, so those colleagues that are listening to this and know about information retrieval, it's not exactly the same. Rather, it has to do with the percentage of the documents that were rejected, what percentage of those are responsive. And the reason that this is useful is because you don't have to go and worry about estimating recall and all that stuff. You just have to evaluate a sample of the documents that have not been produced and compute that number. Even more important for elusion is that it can be turned into a basic quality control test. So you can calculate through a very simple thing that was published in the Sedona Conference Journal in 2007. You can calculate a simple number, and it tells you what the sample size needs to be based on your tolerance for responsive documents being left behind and your confidence level. So let's say that you wanted to make sure that there weren't more than 1% of the documents in the set that was rejected left that were responsive. So if you wanted to do that, then you'd look up in a table that's in that paper how many you have to sample. And if none of those documents, it's an accept on zero criterion, If none of the documents in that sample turned out to be responsive, then you could say with a level of confidence that there were no more than X percent, say 1% of the documents, in the discard pile that were responsive. It doesn't have to be 1%. It could be 0.5%. It could be 10%. It could be whatever number that you want. But you can use that as a quality control tool. What they discuss during the hearing in this case is analyzing the pre-sample. That is, they did a sample of all documents before they did the predictive coding, and then a post-sample. And the post-sample would be they had proposed 2,399 being drawn out of the discard pile, if you will. And the argument would be, if there's a difference between these two, then we can say that we have done an adequate job of identifying the responsive documents. How big does that difference have to be? Well, again, that's another one of those reasonableness arguments that attorneys are capable and judges are capable of making. But you could say, is it statistically significant? Is that difference statistically significant? Meaning, is it not likely to have come by accident? And if it is, then you can say, okay, this difference is reliable, it's real. Is it enough? Well, that's something for the sides to be concerned with.
I mean, isn't one of the things that I think hits people in the gut is this recognition through measurement that, oh my God, we're leaving stuff behind. And it was something that was never talked about or discussed. It's just, here's
right.
your production, okay, or here are your keywords, okay, here's the output. Very little analysis or thought to what, you know, once you got it, what you didn't have it, except from people I've talked to that have finished the process, this uncomfortable feeling that they didn't get everything they were entitled to.
That's right.
And now with
that's
measurement,
right.
now that we are now being forced to measure because we're using systems and, you know, isn't this just a discomfort that we're having?
Well, I think that it is. And, you know, there are people like Maisel Burke and I have been arguing that we should be sampling in e-discovery no matter what technology we're using. And the truth is, Maisel has spent a lot of time singing that song, making that argument to attorneys, and was basically ignored for it.
Hey, he's in a loony bin somewhere now, right? No, I know Maisel. I'm joking. Maisel's a good guy.
Maisel's a good guy. He's got his head screwed on very well, and he's looking out for the benefit of the field.
Yeah.
And he thinks long and hard about these things. But until we got into this technology stuff, I think nobody paid any attention to measurement. They said, yes, we know, but if I measure it, the only thing that will happen is somebody will argue about my measure. So better just leave it alone and nobody can argue with it. It was done by responsible attorneys, and therefore it must be right. So they basically buried their head in the sand.
Because Senior Master Whitaker from the UK, who authored the Goodale opinion, was speaking at Legal Tech this year, and he pointed out a sampling situation where they found, like, I think he said 1.5% of the responsive documents in the null set. And the plaintiffs in that case got very upset and managed to convince the court that this was horrible, and I'm not sure what the outcome was, but he was very disappointed. He thought that was a great result. And I guess this is one of the problems we're going to have to get comfortable with.
Well, I think it is a good result depending on where you start. Now, in this case and with that case that you just mentioned, when the responsive documents constitute only 1.5% or 1.25% of the whole set, you have to realize that you would be right 98.5% of the time if it's 1.5%. By always saying no, this is not responsive. Now that's a pretty hard standard to beat, being right 98.5% of the time. But we recognize that that it's not enough to say in general there aren't any responsive documents here, because there probably are. So we take whatever steps we can take to find those responsive documents, But no matter how you're doing it, no matter what the process is, if you have people reading the documents, you're not going to be any better based on research that we have found and research that Maura Grossman has found and under comparable conditions, what they find in many of the TREC studies, you're not going to be any better. What we found in our paper that came out in 2010 is that if one team identified a document as responsive, the odds that a second team would identify that same document independently, identify that same document as responsive, was about 50-50. That is not stellar. That's not something to go write home about. And in keyword searching, the famous Blair and Marin study from 1985, what they found with careful evaluation was that the lawyers thought they were getting 75% of the responsive documents, when in fact the keyword searching was only getting 20% of the responsive documents.
So, in this case, that initial sample of 2399 randomly chosen documents in De Silva, they found about 30% of them, or 1.25%, to be responsive.
About 30 documents, or about 1.25% or so, 1.5%, depending on which part of the brief or the transcript you're reading. But yeah, it's in that range.
So how would you use that as a starting point to go forward? I mean, do you have any ideas on how to?
Yeah, I mean, you can do the sort of traditional, if we can have a tradition, something that is, you know, a couple years old, in use. Actually, predictive coding dates probably from the 18th century, but we'll come back to that another time. If that's the case, you can use some standard predictive coding techniques to find the responsive documents. You may have to review more documents than you'd have to if the richness were higher in order to be able to find all the responsive documents, because the computer has to learn from examples of the responsive documents. And if those examples only come along every once in a while, well, then you have to wait for those examples to come along. Now, if you're building a seed set, you have to work hard to find the documents that make that seed set. In our Orchitect system, we use random sampling to identify the documents, and so we present a random sample to the reviewer who knows how to judge whether documents are responsive or not, and that works very well. It's much more efficient usually than using a seed set. But if it's the case that that would be too tedious, we can focus in on the documents that are potentially responsive. We can do some keyword searching, and let's say that keyword searching is only 20% effective. Well, if it's 20% effective, then still we're getting 20% of the documents being responsive rather than 1%, and then 80% are non-responsive, so they get marked to be non-responsive. And then based on that learning and maybe some more learning on the whole set, we can apply those same rules to the whole set and measure how we're doing across the whole population. So we can be flexible in our methodology for identifying responsive documents, but ultimately, in predictive coding, it's going to always depend on, have we found an adequate set of responsive documents? Have we found an adequate set of non-responsive documents? And we have to work until we get those adequate sets.
So let's talk about the suggestion by the plaintiffs that they might miss 65% of the relevant documents using the protocol suggested by the defendants. Do you have any type of reaction to that? Because that sounds like a big mess.
Yeah, it would be if it were true. I think that it's a misreading of the TREC results. Look, I'm a big fan of TREC. I think that it is a great annual exercise. The TREC legal track has been doing a great job for us to understand how information retrieval plays an important role, but it's not a company bake-off. It's not intended or designed to be, let me compare this product with this product with this product. It's designed to compare this project with this project with this project, where the projects are not commercial enterprises. The projects are typically academic enterprises, even if they're run occasionally by one of the commercial firms, they are not intended to be able to be a certification of this tool as doing a good job. And one of the reasons for the one of the reasons that they're not designed to do that is they have taken measures in order to save money. So every predictive coding or however you're doing your information retrieval, if you want to compare it against the standard, that standard has to be reliable. It has to be real. It has to be consistent. If it's not consistent, then the performance of any given system is going to be limited by the inconsistency of the standard that they're comparing against. Ellen Voorhees of Trek has done some really great studies where she's found that, independent reviewers of the sort that they use in Trek only agree with one another a relatively small percentage of the time. In the Trek legal track, what they've tended to use are large groups of first-year law students to do the reviews, where each law student might review 500 documents, and they have minimal training because they're not needed for the Trek purposes. The Trek purpose is to be able to compare one against another in a ranking kind of way. They're not concerned with absolute values. Then on top of that, I wrote about that in a blog post talking about some of Ralph Losey's comments a couple of months ago. But on top of that, the 65% thing seems to be a complete misreading of some of the results from Trek 2011. That particular value is taken off of a chart looking at the trade-off between precision and recall, and it's measuring a complex process at one particular point, not how well the ultimate recall will be for that particular system. Ultimately, the recall of the Recommind system in the Trek stuff ends up being much more respectable than that. But in the course of things, they're just misreading the 65%. Incidentally, the 16,555 also seems to be a bad misreading of the Trek results. That happens to be the trade-off point where you get the maximum amount of maximum combination of precision and recall. It has nothing to do with sample sizes. The judgment in Trek was not a random sample, so it tells us nothing about what sample size we need. If we want to measure the recall with a certain level of confidence and a certain confidence interval, then we need a certain number of documents. It's not that number that you're going to get from Trek. The 2,399 is a perfectly good sample for measuring either the prevalence of responsive documents or recall rates. You do not need to multiply that by 7 times, and there is no basis in fact that I can find that would lead one to want to necessarily use that huge sample size, except maybe to make more work.
Yeah, it's good to have that clarification because Trek is the vast majority of statistics that we have come from Trek, and it's critically important that we get statistics like this to get a good understanding of how to impact process. And the original starting of Trek was trying to figure out are keywords working from the first studies that I was looking at with when Jason Barron was involved with the tobacco litigation and approached the people at Trek and with a group of other people, and over time it's morphed into including predictive coding. But I guess it really is it's provided some invaluable guidance on
it has to be interpreted right.
Yeah, and I guess the challenge is once it gets in the hands of lawyers in litigation is they begin to advocate using it in ways that maybe it's not intended.
It wasn't intended. Now, I have absolute respect for Trek and the people who run it.
There's a ton of volunteer time put into that. I mean, the field owes a lot to them, no doubt.
Yes, Yes, and they do a really fine job at what they're designed to do, but their information can get hijacked.
Okay. Well, let's pretend the world of predictive coding doesn't exist. Is there any reason why you couldn't use these same techniques to validate a production? I mean, why wouldn't you want to sample what was left behind in keyword searching, if you thought about it?
Yeah, I think that you should. I think that they've gotten away for so many years with not doing it that I think that that's okay. I've been on some matters where I've been called in as an expert to evaluate the quality of the search results when technology has been involved, and the question that came up in the last one was, well, should we run these same tests on the data that were reviewed by our reviewers? And the answer was, I wouldn't dare. We could never meet that standard. So there's some of that going on. Another reason has to do with things like, how do you sample documents that you haven't collected? If you're using keywords to collect documents, how do you sample the documents you haven't collected? Because if you haven't collected them, you don't have them. And to do that, I think you're going to need some real statistical help. But basically, it involves some hierarchical sampling of units and some pretty deep thought, probably, about how you can generalize from the units that you have selected to the population as a whole. But it is possible to do some sampling that will let you evaluate the documents that you haven't collected. So I think that the real answer to your question is twofold. One is people know that human review is generally difficult, and so therefore the results are not going to be as consistent as one would like. Predictive coding ends up giving you consistent results, if nothing else, and also I would argue highly accurate results when it's done properly. And then the second problem is how do you measure things that you don't have, and that's always a sticking point for trying to evaluate how well you've done in your e-discovery. If you don't start with the right stuff, you can't end up with the right stuff.
Yeah, you know, as an aside on that point, I do some speaking and other events. I've been doing a bit more speaking at CLEs and programs, and I heard a lawyer recently say that even though the statistics on the ability of reviewers to be consistent clearly show that they can't, and even though it takes longer, we still, as a community of lawyers, don't understand predictive coding, and as a result, it may be better for people to move slowly in this space because of the challenges of getting both sides to agree or even getting your team to understand it.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, we're seeing fighting right now with predictive coding, so I think that there's some examples of the challenges that we see.
My own opinion is that challenges.
Lawyers need to learn tools. You know, it's an evolution. And
I agree with that, and I think even above that, there are studies that show that it is not only effective but cost effective. And are you saying to your clients, no, you have to spend more money because I'm uncomfortable and don't want to learn about a new technology? I mean, I don't know where that sits with lawyers and so on. But there's another part to it, and that is that if you go into a matter and you say, look, one tactic that litigants often use is to make it so expensive and onerous for the other side that they give up and settle. Instead, if you use predictive coding, it is accessible, it is easy to explain, and it's inexpensive enough that that you can do your assessment, you can do your discovery. We can settle this case on its merits. I don't have to beat you up and make it expensive for you to bully you into settling we can make this easy on both of us and try the case on its merits.
You know, one of the other issues that's out there, and it's starting to occur, I know of people that are using predictive coding when the other side isn't, is, you know, what do you then do when you get into problems comparing the other side says, why are you giving me this? It doesn't appear to be responsive. And, you know, if you're using a predictive coding tool or some analytics in conjunction with it, and you look at what you've received, you might make a counter argument like, well, why didn't I receive this? Because I don't have this in your production. But, you know, I mean, do you have any sense of how statistics can even the playing field if people use their own approaches?
Well, yeah, you can measure both sides, and you can say, look, I mean, I may have given you some documents that are not responsive. You've given me lots of documents that have been non-responsive. A recent case that we worked on, for example, we got a production from the other side for our client. Of the documents that the other side produced, they ended up judging 6% of them to be responsive. That's of the production. That's not of the original data. That's of the production. So to complain that this document or that document may not actually be responsive, even though it was produced, it's even worse if you're going to use any other kind of technology, like having people read them all, or using keyword searching. You can certainly evaluate from one side to the other as to the success of this. And one of the interesting things about this DaSilva case is that the two sides agreed. Actually, there's only one side with any documents. The defendant agreed to provide to the plaintiff all of the documents that they used in setting up the predictive coding, all of the random samples of documents, any document that they looked at for evaluation purposes, they were going to provide to the other side. So even if the plaintiffs didn't like the measures that the defendant was using, they have access to the documents. They can make their own decisions about precision, recall, illusion, whatever statistics they want to use, they have all the information right there in front of them.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, the last area I just want to touch upon is the pool of data to be tested. And, you know, the other large case, Clean, is clearly heading this direction where the plaintiffs are pushing hard to expand the sampling beyond the original four key custodians selected in one of the nine defendants. And you know, what are the risks that can occur if you limit the number of custodians?
Well, the risks are like the risks that occur when you limit the keywords. The two sides can agree on keywords that they're going to search for, but if you don't know really what's going on, how do you pick the right keywords? Judge Peck and Ralph Losey talk about playing the game of Go Fish. And depending on how many hands of Go Fish you're willing to play, you may or may not be able to find out what documents you need from the other side. And they can hide, if you will, behind their agreement that, well, these are the keywords that you asked for, and this is what we're going to give you. The same thing with custodians. If you want to know, are there other custodians that should be collected? Well, one of the things you can do is to use something like our social network. We have a graph in our tool that shows you who talked to whom about a particular topic, who emailed to whom. And we've had people come in, and one lawyer in a recent case came in. She got one PST as the initial production. She went through that and spent about half an hour seeing who that person corresponded to, who that custodian corresponded with. And looked at the emails that were exchanged and came up with a list of 12 more custodians that needed to be collected, presented that. And the story I heard is the opposing attorney said, how did you figure out so quickly who we needed to collect from? And she said, I just looked at the relationships that were here in this graph.
And on that note, you know, because now we're going into analytics, and although I think analytics, which predictive coding is a piece of, is where the field of law has to go to get smart about this area, why don't we leave that one for a different show? And but I do want to thank you, Herb, for joining us in this real interesting debate that's been going on, helping to clarify it for some of the lawyers out there. It's always a pleasure to have experts like you come to ESI Bytes and share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to ESI Bytes. That's ESIBYTES. You can remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come back to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.